Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has devoted his life to various aspects of that war with great distinction, both in the uniform of the United States Air Force, as a civilian in the Pentagon, in a variety of other capacities, including as the ambassador to the defense and space talks under President Ronald Reagan, is our first guest. He is Ambassador Henry Cooper, the president these days of a marvelous organization, High Frontier. And who better to talk to about all of the issues involving the president's new initiative, Space Force, he calls it, than Hank Cooper, a man who led President George H.W. Bush's efforts in missile defense, among many other things, and knows his way around the heavens, the atmospheric part, and that beyond. Hank Cooper, welcome back. It's so good to have you, sir.
It's good to be with you, Frank. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat about this important matter.
Well, tell us about the importance of it, if you would, Hank. This is something that has been brooded about for a long time. I know going back at the very least to an important commission that Donald Rumsfeld chaired back in the day. Tell us what the importance, as you see it, is of this initiative, President Trump.
Well, I think you will recall Senator Bob Smith from New Hampshire, who, beginning on my watch as SDI director, was always a strong supporter of our space defense system possibilities. And of course, they were killed off by the Clinton years. In the late 1990s, he went in a strong way with the backing of Malcolm Wallop, Senator Malcolm Wallop, and others, to establish a commission to evaluate how the government is organized to deal with space. Became known as the Rumsfeld Commission because Don Rumsfeld was its chairman, filled with a number of very notable people who were former commanders of Space Command and so on. One of the bottom lines that he came to was, and I'm going to quote, if the U.S. is to avoid a space Pearl Harbor, it needs to take seriously the possibility of an attack on U.S. space systems. Now, this was in their report, which came out in 2001, I believe it was. But, you know, the report, we would recognize where we were 20 years ago, and now 20 years later, and $10 trillion later, we're still in that same boat.
Very vulnerable to attacks on our space assets. And as you know so well, Hank, and I think our audience does too, this isn't simply a national security problem. Those space assets are vital to our economy and, well, frankly, even our way of life. And as you see it, Hank, the Space Force that President Trump has now announced he intends to create, I gather it's going to be a separate military service. Will it, if it comes to fruition, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on the challenges to that happening, but if it does materialize, is it likely to be able to protect those space assets properly?
Well, that's a technical issue, but first you've got to organize to deal with it. And I'll stick with Rumsfeld. His commission report said the president really has to take charge of this because of all the diverse activities that you referred to involving space. Different departments, even the Department of Commerce, which most people might not think of, but the intelligence community and DOD and so on. And that didn't happen. That was why he wanted a separate force. That's what he recommended. And at the time, what eventually fell out of that was reorganization, possibly considering an Air Force Space Corps, a Space Corps within the Air Force. And that has not worked out either. And that's because of the bureaucratic pressures that come from a service basically controlled by fighter pilots, if I may exaggerate a little bit. and their priorities are elsewhere. So they naturally went more toward unpiloted air vehicles and so on, rather than going to space for defense or offense or anything else.
And Hank, you've served in the Air Force. You've served as a Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Air Force as well, as I recall. Do you sense that the Air Force is going to continue to interpose objections to the realization of this separate Space Force?
I don't know what they're going to do with respect to the Space Force, but when Congressman Rogers pushed it forward in the House, and Cruz has come up on, you know, for space defenses. And I think that they're both being resisted, certainly by the Secretary of the Air Force and, as I recall, the Chief Staff of the Air Force and so on. So, yes, I expect it to be resisted. Maybe this time out of the political mess will actually come a Space Corps within the Air Force. I don't know. I would hope that the president gets his way. I think we're due a separate force because the issues are really important, and you can't rely on the current system. The last 20 years have proven.
Right. Those bureaucratic forces are going to be at work in the future, too. Hank, let me turn quickly to one other area that you're deeply knowledgeable about as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under President George H.W. Bush. You really led the fight for space-based missile defenses. I know you continue to believe that's the way we need to go. Can we get there from here?
We can if we are willing to take on the issue. And I really appreciate Senator Cruz, Ted Cruz, for putting forward a directive to the Secretary of Defense in the National Defense Authorization Act to start a serious program to develop space-based defenses. That's the most cost-effective system that came out of the SDI watch. And frankly, Don Rumsfeld on his watch completely ignored it in spite of the fact of his report, which indicated we needed to protect our space assets and other systems. And frankly, that has been a dormant activity for the last 20 years, which needs to be revived.
Well, it speaks again to the question of bureaucratic inertia. Don Rumsfeld, to be fair, had a lot of other things on his plate at the time, but the resistance to taking steps in these areas is profound, and I think you're absolutely right, Hank. Has to be overcome by presidential leadership. The president seems to have put that marker down. If he doesn't actually follow through, he will not only be rolled in a rather visible and embarrassing way, but this critical capacity we have to protect our assets and interests in space is going to go by the way.
The first four directors of the missile, what's called the Missile Defense Agency now, agree with what I said a moment ago, that it was the most cost-effective system to come out of the entire SDI effort. And today, if we wanted to do this and we're serious about it, we could restart that program, and for less than $10 billion of 1988 dollars, now $20 billion, we could deploy an effective defense that would provide global protection for our troops and overseas allies, as well as homeland defense against a rather substantial threat from space. So we can do it within 5 years if we set our mind to go do it.
And what an important legacy that would be for President Trump. And I can't tell you, Hank Cooper, how much I appreciate your leadership on these issues over so many years. Keep up the good work, my friend, and come back to us again if you would. Next up, Dr. Mark Schneider, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are joined by Dr. Mark Schneider, a man I've had the privilege of knowing and working with for decades. When we both were in the Pentagon, he outlasted me by many years and continued up until fairly recently to be really one of the country's duty experts on matters involving nuclear forces, various threats therefrom, as well as efforts that have been made over the years through arms control to try to contain or eliminate those threats. He is an extraordinary resource these days, a senior fellow with the highly acclaimed National Institute for Public Policy. He is the author of myriad articles and other longer works on these subjects, and it's always a treat to be able to pick his brain a bit. Mark Schneider, welcome back. So good to have you.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Several alarms are being sounded now, Mark. Our colleague, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, among them. I believe the chief of the General Staff of the United Kingdom as well, according to published reports, are raising the specter that Russia is preparing for war. I'd be very interested in your professional assessment of whether that's hyperbole or, if anything, perhaps an understatement of the seriousness of the intent of Vladimir Putin to take things to the brink if he thinks it's in his interest to do so.
Well, certainly Russia is preparing for war. It's modernizing its entire military. It's staging large exercises on a routine basis. Indeed, there was one just within the last week involving 30,000 troops, according to the Russians. And they're preparing to fight against the United States and NATO, and they're preparing for nuclear escalation as they're preferred theory of victory. And it's a very dangerous situation.
This is the so-called doctrine of escalate to de-escalate that we've been hearing about. And Mark, again, this isn't just a matter of what they're saying in their official writings. This is a question of what they're exercising as well as what they're putting into place in terms of the capabilities to do such nuclear use in connection with their military activities. In this regard, Mark, you've recently written a paper about the tactical nuclear weapons program of the Russians at Real Clear Defense. Talk a little bit about, first of all, the asymmetry between our capabilities in this area and what they're now able to bring to bear.
Well, the asymmetry is certainly enormous. Eliminated almost our entire non-strategic or tactical nuclear weapons inventory after the end of the Cold War. They have retained theirs clearly in the thousands, probably in my view in the 5,000 to 6,000 range, and they've modernized it both in delivery vehicles and in new types of nuclear warheads. We haven't done any of that. And we are almost a decade away from the first modernization of our forces. I mean, other than the F-35, which will be made nuclear capable in maybe 4 or 5 years. But for the strategic systems, we're 10 years approximately away from the first system becoming operational. And we won't be into the early 2030s until all four of the programmed systems come into existence.
And that's assuming they stay on track and are fully funded and no developmental hitches and that sort of thing.
All that's true, and that's not trivial considerations in light of the fact that there's a concerted attack underway inside the Beltway on the U.S. modernization programs, pushing a minimum deterrence unilateral reductions approach to dealing with Putin, which is, my view, crazy.
This is something that we associated with the Obama administration in the past. It's in fairly strong contrast with what President Trump has laid out in his nuclear posture review. Where is this pressure coming from, Mark Schneider, for the reversion to the previous policy?
It's certainly from all the traditional nuclear pacifist groups that are the darling of the liberal media. These people are extremely well-funded. They have tremendous media access, and they present a highly distorted view of what the nuclear situation is between us and Russia and other potential adversaries. And they're doing a lot of damage to our deterrent capability on almost a daily basis. We see these attacks on the NPR very, very frequently.
And when you say they're doing damage to the deterrent, in what sense? That they're potentially putting at risk the kind of modernization programs that are needed, or that they're eroding what is left of the deterrent value of what we have by signaling weakness and irresolution and perhaps a willingness to further engage in unilateral disarmament, Mark Schneider?
Well, both. Deterrence is always a combination of capabilities and perceptions about your willingness to use those capabilities if you're attacked. And they're sending the wrong messages across the board. If they succeed in killing any of the modernization programs, they'll put us in even more of a disadvantage than we are now. And the situation, even best case, is likely to get worse before it gets better, because we are still about a decade away from any, the first of the modernization programs, assuming there's no technical glitches, assuming we continue to fund them.
But Mark, let me just ask you, because I think what's so important in what you're saying is we are no longer in the Cold War paradigm, where we were confronting a very formidable Soviet nuclear arsenal. And as Harold Brown, the former Secretary of Defense, famously said, when we build, they build, and when we stop building, they continue to build. That was bad enough. But what you're describing, Mark Schneider, is not only a very concerted effort by Vladimir Putin to reconstitute, it would seem, in important respects at least, if not in the sheer numbers, certainly in terms of capabilities, the old Soviet nuclear threat. But in addition, we have this new entrant, a sizable, in all likelihood, if largely covert, Chinese nuclear threat as well. Would you talk a little bit about what we know about that and how it ought to factor into calculations of minimum deterrence and so on our side?
Well, for the Chinese, we know a lot less than we would like to know about them. They're extremely secretive. They are at least, at a minimum, an authoritarian dictatorship, and they have elements of totalitarianism as well. They've got a completely controlled press. So from an open source standpoint, there is much less information available about them. Having said that, there's no question that they are engaging in a modernization program that in many respects is quite similar to Putin. And neither of them are sustaining old capabilities. They're dramatically improving their military capabilities as part of this program. And the modernization really is never ending. It's not a situation like we have, where we have a plan to recapitalize the nuclear triad with capabilities, and then at the end of that, we basically stop. That's not what they're going to do at all. When they recapitalize completely, and the announced Russian date is 2027, they'll just go on to the next group of modernization programs. They're behaving increasingly like the Soviet Union with regard to nuclear modernization.
And you know, Mark Schneider, as both of us cut our teeth during the Cold War, I think it's fair to say, were we seeing in that era the kind of level of effort that is being made today by the Russians, and even if it's more opaque, by the Chinese, would be sending off very serious alarms all over the Pentagon and for that matter, the national security community in this country more broadly. And I wanted to just dwell on that point that you made, because I think it's so important. If you're serious about this business, and this is the most deadly serious of all of our national security businesses, we should be clear, you need to be thinking about it the way the Russians are, or the Chinese for that matter, that this is an industrial enterprise that requires the epitome of expert, skilled, capable personnel, as well as physical infrastructure, And that's not the way we've been approaching this at all, is it?
No, we have the threat development, and in both Russia and China, it's increasingly Soviet-like, multiple systems being developed for every leg of the triad, continuous modernization. But the other factor is equally important, and that is the 20-plus year moratorium on any modernization of U.S. Nuclear capabilities. No new nuclear weapons since the end of the Cold War, no new delivery vehicles since the tail end of the Cold War program, 1997.
And all of them flowing, I believe, at least in part, from the decision in 1992 to stop doing nuclear testing, which is, I don't need to tell you, Mark Schneider, a critical ingredient in maintaining the capabilities of both the equipment and the people that we rely upon for this. And Mark, I have to say, you are such a national treasure because you have this understanding of what's required and what, if we fail to meet what's required, are the consequences. And I'm so grateful to you for your continuing service to our country now with the National Institute for Public Policy and for your frequent appearances on this program. We'll look forward to a further conversation with you about these incredibly important issues. Mark Schneider, thank you again for joining us today, and come back to us again very, very soon.
More with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by one of our duty experts on what is happening south of our border. It's particularly important for us to have an appreciation of all of that at a moment when there's a lot of talk here about, well, people coming across our border, many of them illegally and with considerable disruptive effect in our polity. He is, of course, the publisher and driving force behind the Latin American Herald Tribune and Caracas Capital. His name is Russ Dallin. We have the privilege of picking his brains from time to time about a lot of developments that have implications not just for the countries involved or even for the region, but for us here in the United States as well. Russ, welcome back. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a pleasure and didactic learning experience.
Let me ask you about our favorite topic in the portfolio that you cover so well at the Latin American Herald Tribune, Venezuela. There is a report circulating up here that Nicolas Maduro, the dictator there, who has, I guess, pretty much finished the job of running the country into the ground, is nonetheless making a charm offensive with foreign investors, trying to persuade them that Venezuela is actually a great place to sink their cash. Your professional evaluation of that idea?
You'd keep your hands and your money in your pocket and get as far away from them as possible at the moment. You know, so many foreign investors have lost so much money, everybody from the Koch brothers, who are still waiting to get paid for the expropriation of their Fertinitra, their nitrogen fertilizer plant, you know, a decade ago, to Owens, Illinois, to Ford, GM, Clorox, General Mills, Kellogg's.
And a lot of oil companies, too, as I recall.
Yes.
And there are ongoing efforts to extract that funding, including, I saw just recently, a lawsuit for $100 million. Is there any prospect, as you see it right now, Russ, that those who have lost so much money, let alone anybody foolish enough to put more in, will get their money back?
At the moment, no. This is a country that can't feed itself. And as a matter of fact, the lawsuit that I alerted you to yesterday, it was that $100 million one, which is from Lord Vesti, the Vesti Group, which is a large international food and processing and cattle ranching concern that had been in Venezuela since 1905. When it was seized, several different times in the Lord Chamberlain style, they said, well, you have two ranches, we'll keep our other nine in 2006 to bait off the wolf. But of course, the wolf came back, as they often do, in 2011 and took all of their acreage. At that point, they had over 111,000 cattle. 111,000 head of cattle. Venezuela is starving now, can't even feed itself. This is a company that had been there for 115 years, feeding Venezuela and the rest of the world. And now Venezuelans have nothing, like a horde of locusts descend upon a fruitful field and eat and destroy everything.
This is so appalling. And the fact that nothing in a material way is being done to end this travail is something that was impressed upon me. I can't remember if we've had a chance to talk about it, Russ. I was in Peru recently and met people who were talking about the impact that Venezuelan refugees are having on that country. Another one that is even more proximate, of course, to Venezuela is Colombia. And I wanted to talk to you about the migration effect there, and in particular, the recent election that resulted in a fairly robust conservative coming to power. Would you walk us through that?
Yes, it's good news, and for the region and for the what's left of the right-thinking people of Venezuela. Colombia has been a refuge for many of the Venezuelans fleeing the poverty. Indeed, yesterday they raised the minimum wage in Venezuela for the fourth time this year. It's now at just under $2 a month, not an hour or a day, a month. With the raise, and that's hyperinflation is over 150% a month. And here's the thing, you can't eat on $2. I mean, prices, you can get cheap things, but $2, is basically a lunch. Yeah, I mean, that's not enough for your family. So Colombia has been swamped by Venezuelan refugees, but thank goodness, in the ultimate battle between a former guerrilla and from the left and in Colombia and a conservative from the right, the conservative won, and they pointed to Venezuela very often, saying, look what happens, this is the richest country in Latin America, and you put in Cuban style communism there for 15 years, which is what the left and the FARC want to install in Colombia, and this is what becomes of your country.
So they've dodged that particular bullet. What does this portend, as you see it, Russ Dallin, for the so-called peace process between these terrorists, narco-traffickers and the like of the FARC on the one hand and the government of Colombia? There was a lot of opposition to the deal that was struck by the previous government of Colombia. Is it likely to come unraveled? And if so, to what end?
You know, interestingly, the conservative that has won the election and will be the next president of Colombia has actually said he won't even recognize, by the way, the presidency of Nicolas Maduro and will not be sending an ambassador to the country. They'll still have, relations at a lower level, as the U.S. does. We don't have an ambassador in Venezuela either, and neither do they have an ambassador in the U.S. From Venezuela. So Colombia is definitely taking a forceful stand against what has happened in Venezuela. And I think there will be, because the gentleman who won, Duque, comes from the Uribe faction, there's going to be a harsher look at what the peace treaty meant. I think the wider thing is next, after this, the conservatives have won in Colombia, we turn next to Mexico, which will have its election on July 1st. And in this case, a leftist may be the winner.
And this isn't just a leftist. This is a Chavez-style leftist, is it not?
He is. he said a number of things that should be alarming to all of us on the right side of things. And in some senses, it has been a reaction to some of the way that the U.S. has dealt with Mexico in the last few years. So there has been some backlash, and that has caused some of the traditional and more right-thinking and friendly parties to the United States to lose ground against some of the harsher commentary of our current president against the Mexicans, calling them drug dealers and things is not very good for diplomatic relations.
Yeah. So Lopez Obrador, in other words, is sort of playing the nationalist card in the interest of sort of rallying people to him who might not otherwise be willing to throw in with a hard leftist.
Yes. And that's, he's said even things about undoing what they've done over the last two or three years. They opened up their oil investments to outside investors who brought in lots of money. He's talked about saying that that's not a good idea and threatening those investments. So hopefully his bark is worse than his bite. But it does not look good. It looks like the left is going to win in Mexico.
Yeah. I fear that that is not the case in this instance. And, you know, again, Russ Dallin, I said at the outset that we're, of course, in the throes of a pretty substantial thrash at the moment about what's happening at the border and people who are coming from or coming through Mexico to cross into the United States illegally. It is hard to imagine that situation is going to improve if López Obrador is in charge, whether it's because of refugee flows as a result of his repeating mistakes that the left has made elsewhere, notably in Venezuela, or whether it's because of a desire to, you know, move people off their books and onto ours as successive Mexican governments have in the past.
That's true. We are losing a friendship we had in Mexico. I'm sure there will still be some relations, but it will definitely be a downgrade in our relationship, and the cooperation will probably become more difficult.
Hey, Russ, let me lastly ask you about Nicaragua. You have another of these hard leftists, Daniel Ortega, who has, as is their wont, consolidated power doesn't really quite describe it, does it? It's been kind of a communist takeover of the country, as predicted. And he has run it into the ground, also as predicted. The pushback that's taking place is rather impressive at the moment. Give us an update on that, if you would, and where you think it's headed.
The problem with, you know, we like to think in democracy, we like to think that things like this have an effect, but the problem has become that Nicaragua is more communist than democracy, and Cuba has a definite input there and hand in it. So this movement that began on April 19th, it's called the April 19th movement. It's been 2 months since they rose up, you know, an enormous amount of people, an enormous wave, to try and end Mr. Ortega's leadership. You know, who's been in power in the country for almost 40 years now, and who rules with his wife as his vice president. But there's been pushback this week, and they're bringing out the Cuban tactics where they're just bashing heads and, you know, killing people and throwing them in jail.
The old-fashioned repressive response. This is extraordinarily troubling and a subject to which we will return, I'm confident, with you in the not-too-distant future. Russ Dallin, for the moment, thank you very much for this sort of update on what is going on south of the border, as well as what it means perhaps for the border itself and for us as well. Your work at the Latin American Herald Tribune and also, of course, at Caracas Capital is really appreciated. Come back to us again soon, if you would.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. I'm pleased to say joined by David Goldman, one of our rock stars here at Secure Freedom Radio. He is these days the president of Macro Strategy LLC. He writes a brilliant column for Asia Times under the pseudonym Spengler. He is also the author of How Civilizations Die. David, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Frank, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I wanted to pick your brains on the escalating back and forth with China. The Trump administration is, I take it, doubling down on tariffs on a large and growing number of Chinese imports. The Chinese are doing the same, but running out of things perhaps to put tariffs on, given the relative disparity between what we import from them and they import from us, but are looking at other qualitative ways of getting back at us. Give us your read on what's happening and its implications, David.
Well, for the first time ever, we've had an open threat of financial warfare against the United States from a Chinese official, not a top official, but someone who's frequently quoted on behalf of the government, an economist in the Trade Commission. He told Germany's Der Spiegel that if you want to know what's going to happen, read Mao Zedong. You fight your war your way, and we'll fight our war our way. And Spiegel said, well, you own a lot of treasury securities. Wouldn't you hurt yourself if you dump treasury securities? And he said, well, in a war, it's not a matter of who gains the most. It's a matter of who loses the least. And the U.S. is much more exposed to financial problems than China is. So if we go into a trade war with a $1 trillion U.S. government deficit and a vast requirement for foreign borrowing to pay our bills, that could get very ugly very quickly, and it's a very worrying kind of thing. So I think from the standpoint of the U.S. economy, the recent behavior of the stock market is a pretty good indicator that people are concerned. In fact, they should be concerned.
And to the extent that this individual was actually speaking for the government, would you anticipate this kind of new front to be opened up rather quickly in the midst of all of this? David, is there any way of telling how imminent it is?
I think everyone's got their options open. The Chinese clearly do not want a trade war with the United States. It would be harmful for the economy, wouldn't suit their goals. What the Chinese want is the status quo. They're gaining on us, and they want to continue gaining on us until their position is unassailable 5 or 10 years down the road. They don't want an open fight right now. On the other hand, if they're pushed into it, they will dig in. And what Asia Times hears from Chinese government sources is that at this point, they're not going to back down. They will hunker down, and we could, in fact, have a trade war, which would hurt both economies. It's not clear who'd be hurt the worst, but we would both suffer.
Now, David, you have doubtless heard this, ear to the ground as yours usually is, from lots of sources, and that is the point that the Trump administration is making is actually there's been a trade war underway for a long time. We just haven't been fighting to speak of. And the question is, A, is that so, as you see it? And B, are there better ways for us to fight than the kind of tariffs that the president has predominantly been focused on to date?
The decisive thing here, Frank, is that China is a command economy where capital goes where the Communist Party says it's going to go. China's Communist Party has massively subsidized capital-intensive industries. And the result is that the United States private sector has largely stopped investing in high tech. There's virtually no venture capital going into producing more chips, producing better telecommunications, or any of these things.
Because we're simply now buying them from the Chinese?
Exactly. We bought them subsidized from the Chinese. So there are several things we can do. The administration is absolutely right to cut off Chinese acquisition of U.S. technology. Even if they do it fair and square, even if they're paying royalties, even if they're buying American companies at top dollar in the open market, we should cut that off. That slows down the bleeding. But the critical thing is the vulnerability of a command economy is they make massive commitments of their resource to existing technologies. If we develop new technologies that leapfrog the old ones, they're left sitting with the equivalent of a lot of 8-track tape players. And that's what we should be targeting.
This is not an overnight solution, needless to say, but I think you're absolutely right that it ought to be part of the portfolio at the very least. Let me ask you, David, switching gears, there is a presidential election in the offing in Turkey. You have been following for some time both the political changes that have been taking place there under Recep Tayyip Erdogan, as well as their financial repercussions. Give us your read on the lay of the land at the moment. Is Erdogan likely to be reelected? There seems to be something of a race, after all, at the moment.
It's a complete toss-up right now. No one to predict the outcome. Erdogan's real power was based on giving people vast amounts of credit, goosing up consumer spending, building up a huge debt bubble, like a typical third-world kleptocrat buying votes. That's now come to a crashing halt because Turkey's international credit has collapsed. The banks are being downgraded. The currency is at an all-time low. It's lost about 40% of its value in the past year. seems to go down every day the market is open. The central bank has put up interest rates to nearly 20%, but even that has not been sufficient to attract interest in the currency. And the effect of those interest rates is going to crash the Turkish economy. So all the people who went along with Erdogan because, you know, he was giving the economy a sugar high and are realizing that they may go bankrupt. So there's a big backlash against him. I certainly think it would be in American interest for Erdogan to go because he's the major regional sponsor of the Muslim Brotherhood. He's played ball with all of our enemies from ISIS to the Russians buying their air defense systems. He, as your book said, he's an ally no longer. So we can cross our fingers and hope the Turkish voters get rid of him.
Yeah. I wanted just to say my appreciation to you for your contribution to that book, Turkey Ally No More. It's available for free, folks, by the way, at securefreedom.org. You can download it there. David, you mentioned technology and its role in all of this. We are, as I understand it, today supposed to turn over the keys to the first deliveries of F-35 fighters to Turkey. At the very least, this is a pipeline that is in the works as things stand now, though the United States Congress has, I believe, in both houses voted to oppose the transfer of this particularly sensitive sort of leading edge military technology of the United States. Where do you come down on that particular issue?
I would not sell advanced technology to the Turks as long as they're buying top-of-the-line air defense systems from the Russians, which is clearly a violation of their NATO status. I would not give them our best stuff. They're manufacturing F-16s that are licensed. Let it stay at that.
And they are, as you see it, as a result of that kind of relationship with the Russians, and I believe they're buying stuff from the Chinese as well, if I'm not mistaken, compromised in terms of their likely trustworthiness with respect to maintaining these secret technologies of ours?
Turks are completely unreliable. The Turks only weeks ago were threatening to attack American forces in Syria embedded with the Kurds. That's not the kind of thing an ally does.
Yeah, this is what's called a clue in intelligence circles. It's a bad sign.
We should be holding their feet to the fire with every lever we have.
And to the extent that there really is a race underway now, and this is kind of, I must say, come out of nowhere, as far as I could tell. It seemed as though he was a lock for re-election. At the end of the day, do you anticipate that the economy has now reached such a point with his base, his conservative religious base, that even they will now be less inclined to support him? David Goldman?
The hardcore conservative religious base will vote for him, but most of his vote was not hardcore religious. It was economic, because Turkey has had a lot of economic growth. The problem is it was ramshackle and poorly funded growth, which is now going to lead to a horrible reaction. Turkey's basically been living off credit cards for the last few years, and the bill is coming due. So it'll be the economic vote that deserts him. It will take quite some time for Turkey to develop an internal political alternative to Erdogan. The Obama administration loved Erdogan. Obama talked about, you know, how Erdogan was his favorite foreign leader, spent more time on the phone with him than anybody else.
Well, Trump seemed to be fairly impressed with him initially as well. I don't know if that's changed. I certainly hope so, for all of the reasons that you've mentioned. David Goldman, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We'll be watching it closely and look forward to talking with you about it next week. And I hope the rest of you will be joining us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.